Good morning and welcome to Wanda's Picks, a Black arts and culture program of the African Sisters Media Network. And we are so happy to be joined in the studio by Rhonda Benin, who has put together this fantastic, literally fantastic show that's going to be happening tonight in Berkeley. It's called Just Like a Woman, and it's featuring Bay Area vocalists. Good morning, Rhonda. How are you?
Well, good morning, Wanda. I'm doing fine.
Good, good. before we went on the air, you were just telling me how much work it was to pull together this wonderful lineup of artists. I mean, you've got yourself, Kelly Gray, Paula Harris, Terry Odabi, and the Little Armstrong Memorial Band featuring Ruth Davies, Sonia Jason, Ruthie Price, and directed by Tammy Hall. And all that's happening tonight, you know, like one show at 8 o'clock at the Freight and Savage in Berkeley. So where did this concept come from, and how did you do this?
Well, when I was, I spent the whole summer in China working at a dance club, and when I was, deciding what I was going to do when I cut back home, how I was going to do, I was a little concerned about, out of sight, out of mind. I've been gone for 3 months. How will it be for me to start booking myself again? So I thought perhaps it might be better to come up with a concept and try to sell it, and try to work my way back into being around the Bay Area. So I thought about it. I looked at the calendar and thought it was really good. And I thought, wouldn't it be kind of cool to put together?
Excuse me, Rhonda, I'm having trouble hearing you. Is the phone, you're sort of like going in and out, it's kind of can't hear you real well.
Can you hear me now better?
Oh, yeah, that's a lot better. Yeah, I want to make sure
okay,
people
I'm
hear
sorry.
What you're saying. Uh-huh.
All right. I thought that it would be really cool to put together a diverse group of women. Diverse in age, and put it together to show the extraordinary talent that we have. So that was kind of my idea.
Wow. So these are artists that I mentioned. You've had personal relationship with all of them. You perform with them.
Actually, no. I didn't know Paula Harris at all. I didn't hear back and forth on Facebook and sharing thoughts and talking with her while I was in China. Terry Adopt, of course, I know her, but I never really worked with her.
Mm-hmm.
Kelly Gray, I worked with her years ago when I first started here in the 90s with Mal Sharp and the Big Band, and I always had a great time singing with her. And the musicians, yes, I've worked with them on and off in different configurations. Sonia Jason, I've played with Tanto with his Big Band, Bruce Price, along with Tammy and I, Dave Davies, of course, has worked with me, so here and there with my band. So it was just kind of a hodgepodge. I just thought about it and thought, okay, I just had a dream team, and I just went for it.
Yeah, definitely a dream team. And then the Little Armstrong Memorial Band, is this band been pulled together specifically for Just Like a Woman?
Yes.
Nice, nice. Tell the audience. Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
I didn't mention that we also have three young women. We have a Lucy Arden of Berkeley High School senior.
Mm-hmm.
I taught at a girls and youth camp. I think the last two summers, I have Samara Wright, who I taught some of that jam care. And then I have Laura Farms Ford, a graduate from the Oakland School of the Arts, a vocalist and an instrument. So they also will get featured in the show as well.
Mm-hmm. Nice, nice. So for the 3 months you've been away, was that you were touring with your own band?
Yeah, actually I went by myself. There was already a house band at the club that I worked, so
uh-huh.
I took that trip all completely alone by myself.
Okay. So how was that?
Well, to work for 3 months solid, 6 nights a week, without the thought of having a social group, and knowing that you're working is a really big fourth thing at night. It's really, you know, a really good thing. Being that far away from home is, it's hard sometimes, exhilarating. You know, I kind of call it good, the bad, and the ugly, but, you know, all at the same time. It's wonderful, but at the same time, so far away. That I got really homesick, and I wish that maybe I'd been able to bring at least just one person with me from my band, but I was able to make friends. There were other musicians, especially I was very close to Shanghai, so there were other singers from the Bay Area that were there, Darlene Coleman, Denise Minifield, Brenda Vaughn. They were kind of all within reach, so we could talk to each other on the telephone and even come to visit one another because we had some off days. So it was quite interesting. That's what I'll say.
So you said Shanghai, like China?
Yes, I was in Hangzhou, which is an hour away from Shanghai by a train.
Mm-hmm.
Denise Minifield was in Shanghai, so I was close to the shaman. And I believe Brenda was in Beijing.
Wow. So what's the music scene like there in China? You know, right now there's the Karakata Warriors are on exhibit now at the Asian Museum of Art in San Francisco, and I remember when that exhibit came to the Diem Museum before it was remodeled. And, you know, China has this mystique, you know. We think about Nixon in China. We think about Mao Zedong, you know, it's in the Red Book and the Black Panther Party. And
Well, China is still, they're catching up. That's what I could say the most. It's like living in two time zones. It's one very... The young people are modern and hip, and they know a little bit about the world, and the older people don't know anything because of communism. And so it's like living in two places at once. I didn't get a chance to see as much as I thought I would see. When you work 6 nights a week and only have one day off, you don't really have a lot of time to go out and experience, you know, some of the art. I did a little bit during the daytime, but of course my nightlife was me. So I didn't get a chance to do, you don't get a chance to do as much as you think you
do. And so how was the, obviously the reception must have been fantastic. I mean, you were there for so long, right?
Yes. Well, the Jay-Z Club, which is, there are two, there's one in Shanghai, one in Joe, and they're sort of kind of the place to be. So every night the club pretty much packed. The people, I don't think, really come there for the music, honestly. I think they come there to be seen and come there because it's the place to be. But the music takes hold of them. Many of them didn't understand, you know, anything about it. But after one or two songs, they completely understood. even with me singing in English, they got my feeling. They understood my groove. You could tell from the minute that I hit the stage to them laughing at the point that, you know, kind of not understanding who I was to, like, by the end of the first set, I have the whole room. You kind of in the comments. So music has a way to cut through the barriers of language and culture and all that stuff. So it was interesting to see the transformation just during the night.
Yeah, I remember when I first met you artistically was with the Linda Tillery's Cultural Heritage Choir, and I would, you know, come and see you all often because, you know, it's such a unique concept, you know, of singing, you know, our roots music, you know, as people of African descent in this hemisphere, and keeping that alive. And then you all would tell stories, and, you know, just the vocalese is just so phenomenal. And then you had a birthday party at Yoshi's, and it was just your band, and had you on, and you were talking about Pink Champagne, you know, one of your pieces that you've composed, and some of your other music. And that was just really, that was a long time ago. You were one of my earlier interviews, like way back when, and that was so phenomenal. And you were talking about, you know, sort of your artistry and your name. I just love your name, Benin. I just love that country. And I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about your soulful strut band and your, you know, what brought you to Northern California from the Los Angeles area where you I guess you grew up.
Yeah. Okay. I came to the Bay Area just recently. I was just finishing up that period. I was instructional aid at the summer came. I had, you know, summer off, and my best girlfriend was in high school, and her family lived in Oakland. And I thought, let's just go somewhere for the summer, you know, and just maybe live somewhere else for a little while, not Los Angeles. And I came up here with the intentions of going back home. And after spending a month here, I decided that I didn't want to go home and be back because I'd seen something that I'd not seen in Los Angeles. I ended up on about 30 years old, and I wouldn't have as much success as a solo artist in Los Angeles. I was like getting too old, you know, even at 13, too old, you're not thin enough, you're not pretty enough, you're not a whole bunch of knots.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got here, I started seeing I was going out all the time, just seeing different things and taking advantage of people. And I was seeing actresses and actors, you know, seniors, and I saw full-figured girls, like a ghost thing. Stuff, putting on shows and getting down. And then I went to parties, and there was diversity at the party. I went to a premiere, and it said salsa dancers, all races, having a good time together. And honestly, I've never seen anything like that in Los Angeles. At the end of the day, everybody goes to their respective corner, and that's the end of it. And I was just amazed by the real diversity. Talk about diversity, but I saw it in action here, so I decided I'm not going to go home. I'm staying. So that was the reason why. You know, that's the reason why I stayed here. In all honesty.
Yeah. Your first CD you released in 2006, A Matter of Heart, a classic mix of jazz, blues, and soul, and you have. I agree. Some of the Bay Area's finest musicians, Tammy Hall, who is collaborating with you once again on Just Like a Woman, which again is happening tonight, this concert celebration of women during Women's History Month, is an event not to be missed tonight, 8 o'clock at the Freight and Savage, 2020 Addison Street in Berkeley. And the phone number there is 510-644-2020. Tickets are $22.50 in advance and $24.50 at the door. And you can email info@freightandsalvage.org, and you can get tickets online, I believe. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, right. Well, your debut CD features, again, Tammy Hall, drummer Daryl Green, saxophonist Charles McNeil, guitarist Cedric Dennis, and bassist Ron Belcher. So it's like, oh my goodness. So what CD are you on now? Which release are you on presently?
I'm not released another CD. That's the only one left.
Okay.
We're hoping to possibly this group. But I spent a lot of my last couple of years making sure that I can live my future in my senior years as I approach them with a little bit of calm and he girded up a little bit. So I've been interested in teaching and furthering my education. So I thought, okay, let's take care of that now.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll be sure that I can, you know, continue with my group, continue with my band, continue with my singing, but at the same time, have seed money, and then I, you know, and I might not want to travel so much anymore that I'll be stable. So that's where I've been putting my interest and my brain. They've been going in that direction.
Right. Yeah. Your vocal range, you know, covers jazz, blues, rhythm and blues, big band, pop, and African American folk songs. And your voice has been described as caramel sweetened with honey. Nice. And you've actually performed for 9 years with Mel Sharpe's Big Money in Jazz Band, and you write that it gave you visibility on the nightclub and festival circuits, and that's, you know, sort of what led you to form your band. But then, you know, your work with Linda Tillery goes back to the beginning, because she met you, I believe, at the Oakland Ensemble Theater, where you were working, you know, when you came here to Oakland. Back in 1989, and you were you sang. I think you write that you have been working on the weekend gig with singer Maria Maldar, who's actually been on the air. She's been our guest a couple of times, and then you got you went from Oakland Ensemble Theater, opportunities in live theater and singing commercial jingles and getting your Afro card, and you got a better job, you write, as a chorus manager of the esteemed Oakland Youth Chorus, where you met Linda Tillery, and then, you know, as they say, the rest is history. Yeah, and gosh, I mean, I was just looking at sort of the roster of people that you've sang with in that role. You've sang with Taj Mahal, Wilson Pickett, Richie Havens, Odetta, Al Green, Kev Moe, Santana, Patti Austin, Janice, is it Ian?
Janice Ian.
Jackson Brown, Hugh Masekela, Sweet Honey in the Rock. And then in 2011, you've been artist in residence at 4 Bay Area elementary schools, and you're on the teaching staff of Jam Camp West, Hillsburg Jazz Festival, Operation Jazz Band, the San Francisco Arts Project. You're a busy woman. Girl Blues and Jazz Camp. And you conduct your own school assemblies and workshops. The Voice, The Hands, The Feet, Twist and Shout, and Love Letters Make Me Misty Blue. So you are a busy woman.
And I have a new one called Jazz Ain't Nothing
But Blues. So what's it doing?
I have a new assembly and a new show called Jazz Ain't Nothing But Blues as well that I can do as a guest. So I'm always, you got to keep thinking. You have to come up with some new ideas. and I coupled my background, my education background, with my performance background.
Mm-hmm.
To keep moving. My talent as a teacher and my relationship with kids is pretty big, and it's a way to keep working. It's a way to not be worried if there aren't any nightclub gigs. You know, and nightclubs are cropping up around Oakland here lately. The last couple of years, at one point, I had so many gigs in San Francisco, and those clubs, one after one, began to close. And so you have to rethink what you're doing here, and how do I stay current? How do I keep working? What can I do? And actually, within the Linda Tillery group, we began to do school workshops in addition to our night concerts.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw right away that we needed a lesson plan, that we needed something to send to the teachers before we got to the school so they know what to expect from us.
Mm-hmm.
So I began to grab on to my education and my past as a teacher's aide and what I knew how to do. and I just coupled them together, and it started a whole project.
The educational piece, you know, is very important because, you know, this music that you all are going to be sharing with us this evening is music that has, you know, is telling a story of our country.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about the blues tradition and some of the women, you know, that you all are going to be lifting up. Let's start by talking about Lily Armstrong.
Well, I didn't do so much studying on Lily, and I just can't do that part. I handed that all over to her. I named the band. And because I knew that Lily had a big part of early career with the earlier band, and you could see her sitting at the piano, but she was a writer and composer, and there's just not ever enough information about her. So I named the band after her, but I'm in so much with her background. Candace wants to be, band is going to be one of her competitions tonight. So honestly handed that part over to Candace, to be honest.
Wow. So you can at least tell our audience who she is. I mean, she is the wife of...
The first wife of
Louis Armstrong, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. So tell us about the history of the music that you're going to be sharing with us and some of the women, you know, locally that might no longer be with us and those that are with us that you all are going to be lifting up, you know, in spirit as you sing and perform.
Well, you know,
I can't hear you anymore.
I'm sorry. I pulled my phone away. You got me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay, I'm sorry. I music that was composed by women or made popular by as well as it all shut up the whole cast being female. We're doing I'm doing People Make the World Go Round, which is written by Linda Creed and Tom Dell, who wrote many, many hits for the Philadelphia Sound, a stylistic. Linda Creed died pretty early in her 30s of ovarian cancer, but she left a wealth of, you know, a whole songbook of songs. So I picked her. I think Cherry's doing I Can't Stand the Rain, very popular, written by the Memphis singer, and people. We have Dr. Stillwood written and performed by Frank and Paula doing. Let's see. Kelly's doing A Kiss to the Casket, made popular by Ella Fitzgerald. So we try to be cognizant of what we were doing and to also give honor to some of those women writers who have passed on. In terms of many women around here, if I had it my way, I would have, you know, this thing could go on for a week.
Yeah,
I mean, there are many, many fabulous musicians, singers that are female that are here could have gone on for days.
Mm-hmm.
But we couldn't do that. And my hope is that the place sells out and we can extend it maybe to a two-day festival. And then bring in, you know, some other acts. Paige Carroll and Kate Carrier that they missed. And Kim Nally. And then there's a whole group of young women. Valerie Trout, Jennifer Johns, Tamika Cole, Lisa Malone. There's just, it could go on forever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's excellent. So are we going to have to wait all the way until March next year for this to happen?
I'm not sure if we want to. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. You know, maybe not. Maybe next week I might, after I get a little rest, see how it went, think about it. I may right away begin to pitch it to some other houses right away and see, you know, what we can do, if we can move forward. You know, I'll know tomorrow morning.
Okay.
Okay.
Right, we will. Yeah, well, hopefully you'll know something good, because that was that's a great idea to have, you know, a series, like, you know, maybe not every month, because that would be a little bit too much on you, but be great if quarterly, you know, you could put on one of these, you know, one of these concerts, just like a woman, featuring Bay Area vocalists. That would be super. And then, you know, it would be really great, and I don't know if you have planned on doing this, are you going to record it and see what it sounds like and maybe release a Just Like a Woman featuring Bay Area artists, Bay Area vocalists, Volume 1?
You're pushing it, Wanda. I don't know yet, you know, because then I have to sit down with the artist. You know, it takes a lot to... you can dream up this stuff, which I learned. There's just going to do it.
Right.
So, excuse me. So I'd have to go and talk to the artist, and then we have to bring the sound crew, you know, and really get it recorded well. So, you know, let's do this first one.
Okay. All right.
See how it goes. Then I can sit down. We can sit down and evaluate it, take our notes, see where we fell through the cracks, see where we were successful. Actually, this time, build a team. I don't quite have the team of workers that I needed.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't have maybe embarked on this by myself. Thank God Terry O'Dobby stepped in and got busy right along with me. But I probably need a stronger team, maybe a 4 or 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could really get in there to do the publicity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot of little fires that I found myself like, oh, I'm going to learn. I'm going to learn. This is my first time really using a show that's just not just fit me.
All right. Yeah. So I want to let you rest your vocal cords, and so I just have a couple of more questions. I wanted to ask you again to talk a little bit about the tradition. You know, sort of like where this music comes from. You know, give us a little history lesson. Put on your teacher hat.
So which music are you talking about?
Jazz? Talking about jazz and blues, the kind of music you all are going to be performing. Yeah.
Well,
where did that...
my answer is that the starting point is Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Then with the slave trade, where Africans were brought to America. This music springs from that time, spiritual, field hollers, some work songs, and it moves through. If you are honest about it, the music, the story of African Americans is embodied in this music. The stories that couldn't be told, that weren't written down, are all embodied within the music. And so I'm always speaking up for the African-American contribution in this music, because to me, the time moves on, so African-American contribution is pretty much kicked to the side. And I'll tell you, anybody can do this. Go to any encyclopedia and look up the definition of jazz, and you'll begin to see that the African part of it is falling further and further down in the definition as it becomes American music. So I get into fights with people. I've been called racist, all sort of things, but the truth is the truth. And so I think it's my job, no matter what kind of heat I get, that I'm going to stand up and tell the truth and stand up for the real roots of blues and jazz. I'm not saying that anybody cannot play it. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that the real root of all of it is that. So, be it.
Right, yeah.
Yeah. So, I'm going to get blasted probably in the next few minutes on Facebook. But, I, you know, just what it is. America in its trouble with African American, in its trouble with race and racial issues, has trouble with African American contribution and influence. And it gets negated or cut to the side a lot of times, and sometimes replaced by a lot of foolishness. But the truth is, without Ma Rainey, without Beth Smith, without Sister Rosetta Starr, you know, where would we be?
I was just thinking back on a performance that I saw you all in with Linda Tillery, you know, doing our roots music, and you and Eloise Burrell, you came out and you all were dancing, and you know, which is really great because you know the music does. Is not, you know, sit and clap your hands kind of music. It's you move to this music, and I just thought it was just really lovely, you know, watching you all dance. There wasn't room for the rest of us to get up and perform as well, but it was really cool, you know, watching you all, you know, dancing as our ancestors did, you know.
That was called a buzzard nose dance. I think you were either doing a ring shout or a buzzer close. Those are all just somebody's labor. And there's folk stories, folklore, you know, that go along with those things. It's what it's called.
And you know, when your repertoire takes into its in consideration these pieces, then our history and our people live, which is really wonderful.
You know, I'll give you a chance. And then I'm like, the part of
yeah, you're breaking
you
up again.
Okay, I'm moving the phone away. Sorry. And the most of her music that she performed was all African American music. I saw her, and we were having lunch, and I don't think Linda had seen her show. She asked the woman, what kind of music was she performing? She kept saying folk. So Linda kept pushing her and saying, what kind of folk? She kept saying, well, just regular folk. And Linda said, yeah, but when it says folk, that means it's associated with somebody. So, which folk? And we never could get that woman to say African American folk music. So Linda kind of pushed her further, and so she said, well, tell me the song. And so she started naming off songs, which were all spiritual. And then Linda kind of asked her, so you could never verbalize. And I'm always taking note. I'm always listening. And so we see that often. Just verbalizing. Give credit for credit. So I don't want to get scared. So you got any more questions? All right.
Yeah. Wow. Well, next time we talk, I hope we have a better connection because you've been like fading in and out, and I really want our audience to be able to hear everything you're saying because it's so wonderful. And we'll have to get some of your music next time. But we've been talking about, you know, women artists, and you mentioned Kim Nally, and I happen to have some of her music in my in the studio, and she's singing Nina Simone, you know, that album of hers. And so I was thinking. Be really perhaps I don't know I kind of think the linkage would be kind of cool playing I wish I knew how it would feel to be free since we've been talking about our ancestors and the traditions that came out of enslavement into liberation and just congratulations on this wonderful concert that we are just so looking forward to this evening, Just Like a Woman, in celebration of Women's History Month, featuring Bay Area vocalist yourself, Rhonda Benin, Kelly Gray, Paula Harris, Terry Odabi, and the Lil Armstrong Memorial Band with Ruth Davies, Sonia Jason, Ruthie Price, Tammy Hall as music director. And then you mentioned these other special guests, these younger singers.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Lizzie Arsenal, Marilyn Ford, and Tamara Rice.
Mm-hmm. Wow, wow. Yeah. That's all happening. My goodness. 8 o'clock.
Are we going to 2 hours.
That is like, whew, man. Tonight, March 27th, at the Freight and Savage in Coffee House in Berkeley, California. So you want to visit their website and get your tickets because the venue could sell out. And that would be so
exciting.
I know. Yeah,
it
Ron would
be
so happy.
Exciting. Yeah. You know, next time we talk, let's do a show. Let's listen to some of these older blues. And there was a brilliant PBS show on Sister Rosetta Tharpe, American Masters.
Really?
That came on last week. And I learned some things that I didn't know more about her. And so this is intriguing. Her career.
Mm-hmm.
Moving in and out of sacred and secular music, and the longevity of it, and the conversation about Elvis Presley and how he really was listening to her and watching her and taking his cues from her. It was a really, really great piece. I'd love to go into the music of some of those early blues records because I think that they get ignored. Not so much Bessie Smith, but we forget about Ma Rainey a little bit and Sister Rosetta. So I like this.
And also Alberta Hunter, right?
And Alberta Hunter, Penny, Elizabeth Cotton.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the cotton picking on the guitar. I had no idea that was about that woman in that song Freight Train. I mean, she sang that at camp.
Mm-hmm.
Who knew?
Right.
So it's just a whole lot of information that we can get out that will empower young girls and young African Americans also are sitting in classrooms just, you know, mindlessly. And there's so much information that can empower them and bring light to their eyes.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a lot of work to do. I really want to thank you for this interview and thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, you're welcome, Rhonda. Thank you for sweetening the path for us with your lovely voice and your even though it's difficult, I'm glad that you keep on moving. You keep on strutting, as you would say. is your family more recently from Texas? So I hear that there are a lot of Texans in the host. Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, that's been
everybody black from Los Angeles that were either to me in my growing up were either from Louisiana or from Texas.
Yeah. Did you visit your family when you were growing up?
No.
Mm-hmm.
No, I didn't. They came to California, but my grandmother didn't want to go back to Texas.
Mm-hmm.
I never got a chance to ask her about that. I didn't understand it till later.
Mm-hmm.
Why she never wanted the team to go. She never really wanted to go back. But oddly enough, many of my cousins have sold their homes in Los Angeles and are all back there on our land. We've got lots of land now.
Nice.
So they're building homes and going back. So it's that in another 10 years, you know, I might go back too.
Yeah. What part of Texas is your family from?
A little place called Hooks, Texas. Texarkana.
Oh,
it's where Bill Clinton is from.
Wow, that is amazing. Yeah. My family's from New Orleans, Louisiana, and we're also we have family in Mississippi. And my father never wanted to go back either. So family would come visit us, and we'd talk on the phone and send letters and meet halfway, like in Chicago or Texas. And then they would come see us there. Yeah, but he just couldn't handle the segregation anymore. He hated it.
Yeah, they
had to
bad
memories,
and they didn't
want to
go back there.
Yeah. Well, let's definitely, schedule you to come back on, and we could talk about some of the, you know, some of the folks that, you know, laid the foundation, particularly some of those that you mentioned whose names are not as well known as some of the, you know, people that were inspired by them, whose names are better known. Okay, cool. Well, you rest up, save your voice, and looking forward to seeing you this evening. Thank you so much for today. And, yeah, and if you want to send me some music once you rest up, we can play it and just talk about how great the concert was, and I'll just play it. It's like, did you hear her? Blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
And but in the meantime, people can visit your website. It's a wonderful website. And it's Rhonda Benin, RhondaBenin.com, and you can find out more about Ms. Benin and get in touch with her about some of the great workshops that she leads, and check her calendar and buy her CD, and yeah, just be encouraging.
All right,
thank you so much. You take good care.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Bye bye. Peace and blessings. So here's Kim Nally singing, I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight.
Well, I wish that I knew how it would feel to be free. Well, I wish that I could break all of the chains that are holding me. Well, I wish that I could say all of the things that I should say.
Ah, that was Kim Nally singing Nina Simone. That's the album that this particular selection came from. And Kim Nally is a Bay Area vocalist, and I'm sure you have seen her, but can't see her enough. And just wanted to play that because we don't have a Rhonda Benin, but we will. And also wanted to play something from Keb Mo because he is an artist that Rhonda has performed with. And I was thinking about playing Imagine, and then I thought about, someday we'll all be free. We'll be kind of like in the thematically sort of where we're going today. And then, you know, or Wake Up Everybody, that's a really nice one too. So I'm like, oh, eeny, meeny, miny, mo, I'm not certain which one to play. So, and then we're going to play something from Karen Allison, and then we're going to jump right into a wonderful interview that I had with Toby Winham, who is playing, he's performing in Marin Theater Company's latest or closing season closer, the play The Whipping Man. Is opening tomorrow. So much great stuff happening. Oh, you know what I was thinking? Maybe I should play the interview with Rodessa as well. Yeah, I probably should do that because Rodessa's The Resurrection of She opens at Brava tomorrow as well, and that's so exciting. That's going to just have a short run, I think a couple of weeks, and definitely don't want to miss that. That's in San Francisco. On Mission, not Mission, it's on 24th Street at York, wonderful venue, and Marin Theater Company's production of The Whipping Boy is going to be up through the 21st of April, so you have some time to get there, but this week is the preview, so hey, you want to save a little money, you can go for a little, go see the play at a bargain price. And don't forget, Katari Hall's play, The Mountaintop, is continuing through next week. That's at Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts. So I'm going to play, I think I'm going to play Wake Up Everybody, and then I'm going to play the piece by Karen Allison. It's something about spring. I have to announce it when I get to that part. Here we are with Keb Mo.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking. Changed so very much the way it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Wake up all the teachers, time to teach a new way. Need it in their lesson for what you have to say. They're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can.
Change.
I was a sentimental thing. Threw my heart away each spring. Now a spring romance doesn't stand a chance. Promised my last dance to winter.
Spring can't really hang you.
Well, that was Karen Allison, and that was Spring Can Really Hang You Up, and happy spring. We've been in the spring. You wouldn't know it was the spring because it's been kind of chilly, but spring is here as of March 20th. Good morning, Paula. How are you?
I'm doing wonderfully. How about yourself?
I'm fine. We were just calling your name, you know, saying, yeah, Paula Harris is going to be one of those women featured in this wonderful program, Just Like a Woman. I'm like, where is Paula? And it's like, Paula doesn't have the information.
Paula was fixing her cup of coffee.
Okay, so Paula's nice and awake now with that caffeine doing its thing, huh?
I am.
Yeah.
Getting ready for tonight. It's going to be a great show.
Yeah, I was just really enjoying. It's so fun. Your debut album is just so nice.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm listening to it last night, and trying to think which songs do I like the most. Like, I like them all, and they're just like, you know, the different. They're so fun. particularly the one Just Don't Look Good Naked Anymore Blues.
Yeah.
That was hecka funny.
We wrote another one that we can't even put on an album. It's so bad. It's called A Little One Slipped Out. Not let you figure out what it's about, but I like funny lyrics.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, you know, one good, great thing about the blues is that it takes a sophisticated listener to understand, you know, what these stories are saying. So it takes a lot of skill to write these pieces.
Oh, thank you. Well, I never thought about it. To me, if you can give me the hook of a song, mm-hmm. and then give me the form, whether it's going to be a 12-bar ballad, whatever, I can kind of just drop them in there. And I've always been able to do that. But a lot of the times, it takes someone listening to figure out a lot of blues tunes are wrought with innuendo. And mm-hmm. so it takes someone listening to, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the Sarah Vaughan song, Long John Blues, and about the trip to the dentist.
Oh, no, I don't know that story.
Well, it's pretty funny. I mean, it's from the 40s, and it says, you know, he took out the drill, told me to open wide, said he wouldn't hurt me, but he filled that hole inside.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, because what's really lovely about the blues is that you can have a general audience, and you know, the folks that have been around a little bit, they'll understand, and the folks that haven't, they won't. They'll just think it's about a dentist.
It's always nice to see whose mind's in the gutter.
No, I just think, you know, people with experience, and I think that's an aspect of songwriting and composition that's lost, you know, to some of the, you know, music that we hear coming out, you know, the more popular music. There's nothing
yeah.
up to the imagination.
I think the music today kind of insults the listener, to be honest, because it doesn't, the lyrics are not great for the most part. Music could be something in most cases that a computer could put together, and it's kind of lost the human element in favor of marketing. And, you know, as the audience that they are marketing to, it's up to us to either say, yeah, yeah, we'll buy this, or no, you need to give us something better before we spend our money.
So you you come by your I guess skills I guess I'm trying to think I mean you're actually you know you are from that place in our country where you know this music and this history started you know you're from the South and
yes I am
yeah, South
can't
there,
you tell.
Yes, I can. I hear an accent. It's like, whoa, that's nice. And, you know, you live in San Francisco now, but you haven't lost your southern roots, huh?
No, I never will. And, yes, I still eat cornbread and collard greens and all that good stuff and grits. Although I have to order them online.
I was looking for grits in Safeway, and they don't have grits. Yeah,
they do under those Bob's, the bags where you get like the milled quinoa and stuff. It's called Bob's Red Mill. Anyway,
oh, that's where it is. Okay, I couldn't find it. Yeah, I was like instant, quick. I'm like, that's not what I want. I don't want instant. I don't want quick. I just want just regular.
But you got to know how to make grits. You know, it doesn't help because grits are pretty bland by themselves. So
mm-hmm.
You got to know how to spice them right.
Well.
No, but back to what you were saying about the music. I mean, what has amazed me, being, you know, from both sides of the country, is that what is considered blues out here, in a lot of cases, is like, they call it jump blues. We called it swing, and it was considered part of big band. Whereas what I grew up listening to is the blues, which is Little Milton, Etta James, you know, Buddy Guy, that kind of stuff. That is considered R&B out here. And it's really fascinating to see how different, you know, the cultural aspects of how they view the music is from one coast to the other one.
Yeah, I was, you know, reading your bio, and it says that, you know, besides being a native of South Carolina, you're a classically trained vocalist. But with a style obviously influenced by the likes of Etta James, Diane Shore, Gladys Knight, and Aretha Franklin, it was only natural for you to gravitate toward the genre of blues, jazz, and soul. And while most vocalists who cross genres tend to choose songs that fall into a middle ground between them, your astonishing versatility allows you to sing the full spectrum of all three. So why don't you talk a little bit about, you know, your work with symphony orchestras, you know, and as well as, you know, some of the other blues scenes, because you just won more recently the Monterey Blues Festival's 2012 Battle of the Bands in November of last year. And and then you were it was a warm up to represent San Francisco Bay Area in the International Blues Challenge held in Memphis, Tennessee, where you placed in the top three best bands in the worldwide competition after receiving standing ovations at all stages of the competition. Yeah, so why don't you talk to us about, you know, sort of how classical meets blues, and then tell us about this this International Blues Challenge. That sounds really fun.
Okay, well, in a nutshell, I had a chorus teacher who was, she worked at the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and then she decided to have a family rather than a career, and she ended up teaching choir at my high school, and she saw my potential, and she basically pulled me aside and took me under her wing and said, you know, Paula, you may not want to be an opera singer, but if you let me teach you these techniques, you'll be able to sing any style you want for as long as you want without hurting your voice. And I'm really glad she did, because I think that even if you're, you know, no matter what genre you are, classical singing is all about using the proper technique and treating your voice like an instrument and taking care of it when you sing and when you're resting and, you know, how to warm up and all of these there's different things between chest and head. I'm not going to go into that. But if suffice to say that if you learn the proper foundation, the house that you build on top of it is going to be stable. And so that's what I took away from the classical music. And yes, I did sing with the symphonies, and that's it's a pretty powerful high to get up in front of 72 musicians, although it's kind of scary, too, because with a smaller band, if you mess up, they can follow you. But with 72 people, you're just out there vulnerable. So you better have it down. But as far as the International Blues Competition is concerned, there's an organization called the Blues Foundation, and they do so much to help keep the blues alive through preservation and all different kinds of things. And the International Blues Challenge is the biggest band competition in the world, like of its kind, that they hold. And it also, it's kind of like the American Idol of blues. You have to win a competition in your area to go there. And when you get there, there's 1,000 musicians from 40, I think there's over 40 states that compete in more than 20 countries. And basically, if you can get into the top three in the blues, that IBC competition, a lot of doors open for you, and it pretty much cuts off 10 or 20 years of, you know, paying dues in the genre. And we went up there, and I mean, we were a brand new band. We just started. We'd only had a couple of rehearsals when we won the first round. And then when we went up to and my band members were like, we don't stand a chance in hell of making it, you know, all the way through the finals here in the Golden Gate Blues Society's area, because there were so many good bands that we were competing against. And then when we won that one, we were like, oh, my God, now we're going to Memphis. And when we got to Memphis, we knew what we were up against. And we just kind of made a vow on the plane that we weren't going to go to win, because that seemed like such a long shot, and we were just going to go and focus on each individual performance and give the best performance that we could. And when we kept going through, I mean, nobody was more flabbergasted than us. You know, it was just amazing. And it was also very gratifying, and it kind of gave me that, you know, I'm 46, nobody told me to get a real job and quit, you know. And so it gave me that it gave me that little, I guess, needed incentive to really go after it full force and to not give in and to, you know, because it's hard to go against naysayers when they're telling you, you can't, you can't, you can. They kind of run you down, and you need to be more stubborn about saying, I can, I can, I can. So if there are any people who are listening in your audience that are that enjoy the blues, I strongly, strongly suggest that they join one of these area blues. There's the Bay Area Blues Society, there's the Golden Gate Blues Society, there's the Sacramento Blues Society, and there's also a brand new one called the Silicon Valley Blues Society. And these organizations will help support your music. They'll provide you a network of musicians. And also, if you get your band to the point that you're ready to compete in that IBC, it is the American Idol of blues, you know, competitions, and it will put you where you want to be if you do well in that competition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So tell us about tonight. What do you have planned? What are you singing?
Oh, well, I'm just excited. I've been listening to, when I first moved to the Bay Area, Kelly Gray and Terry O'Dobby were two of the vocalists that I, you know, stumbled across online, and I just loved them. And, you know, I wrote them, and of course they had no idea who I was, and they were like, well, thank you, but that was it. And then I met Rhonda online also a couple of months ago, and she and I had a couple of, you know, messages back, actually pages of messages back and forth. And we shared music, and, you know, I just really respected her talent. And so when she called me and asked me if I could do a show with these other ladies, I was like, well, let me think about it. Yeah. So, and we are doing, I was actually really surprised because the other ladies are known for jazz, and I'm pretty much blues, but they asked me to do Dr. Feelgood, and then they wanted me to do one of my originals off the album called Nick of Too Damn Late, which was the single that we released. And then I'm also doing a funny thing. There's a song that we do in our shows to illustrate that all forms of American music sprang from the blues. And what we do is we take AC/DC's Back in Black, and I sing My Funny Valentine over it to show that it all has the same root form.
Wow.
So those are the songs that I'm singing.
Wow, that is so neat. So do you know any, like, do you know Tammy Hall already? Do you know, like, the members?
Oh, yes. Ruth Davies and Tammy Hall and Sonya Jason and Ruth Price are so respected in the community. And, you know, just and Tammy I have known from, you know, from other bands, and Ruth Davies I've known from all kinds of work that she does. I had not known Sonya and Ruthie Price, but when we went into that rehearsal, you know, to be four people that had never worked together plus a vocalist, and for it to just, bam, right into place, you can tell the level of talent that's there. And there's also some extremely talented young ladies that are going to be surprises for everybody that are, you know, the next generation up and coming. So it's going to be an, we've been laughingly calling it the Estrogen Fest. But it's going to be a good show. We've got people coming from as far as like San Jose down to the show. So it's going, I think it's going to be a good show. I think it's going to be a packed house. And I think everybody's going to feel like they had an evening well spent.
Yeah, when I was talking to Rhonda, and she was trying to save her voice because she was feeling a little hoarse yesterday evening. I was saying it'd be really great if you all could come out with Just Like a Woman featuring Bay Area Vocalist Volume 1, and then you know, have this show, you know, maybe quarterly, if not sooner, so that, you know, we have an opportunity to see, you know, this rich rich artistry that lives, that's right here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
It's you know, I'm writing some articles for some various publications, and one of them is about the Mecca of musicians that are in the Bay Area, because, you know, when I travel around, especially when you go, being blues, when you go to Memphis and Mississippi and those people, they kind of think they have the cornerstone on it. But, you know, when you come out here, it's really astounding. Because I've lived in Atlanta, I've lived, you know, all over the South, and out here, I have to say that I have never been anywhere where there was such a concentration of professional caliber musicians. And, you know, when I talked to Rhonda, she said she was actually going to try to take this and make it what you just said, and make it a, you know, a regular event. And I think that's a fantastic idea, to introduce people to the talent that's just right next door.
Right. Yeah, that'd be really super. Wow. And I wanted you to talk a little bit before you go, because I don't want to keep you, because you've got this big concert tonight, about your band and about, you know, your creative process. Because I was looking at your website, PaulaHarrisMusic.com, and you've got, like, really nice song set lists, and then next to the ones that are yours, which are quite a few in various genres, you have original song, and there are quite a few original songs.
We do about 80% original music, and that's what we wanted to. There's, within the Blues Foundation, that organization I mentioned earlier, they have a thing called, it's called KBA, which is Keeping the Blues Alive, and a lot of people focus on preservation, which means, you know, introducing people to older music, but and I think that's wonderful, but the way that I approach it is you have to allow the blues to kind of morph and be attractive to a younger audience. And so we're kind of a combination of, you know, we're definitely a funky, bluesy hybrid, kind of think Adele and Amy Winehouse meet, you know, classic soul bands like Tower of Power, that kind of thing. But my band is just the dream band to work with, and we call them the Beast of Blues, because each one of them is individually their own band leader, and they have their own followings, and they just love each other so much, and we have so much fun when we play that they're committed to this project just for the sheer passion of it. And the Beast came about because Beast sounds better with blues than monsters, so they're all monsters on their instrument. Beast, monsters, that's how it happened. And we've got D-Mar on the drums, Derek Martin. He's been with Little Richard for 17 years. You know, then you've got Terry Hyatt, who has, when I went around to find a guitar player, I started asking guitar players, who's the best guitar player in the area? And his name kept coming up. And so I called him up, not realizing the magnitude of the stones that it took to approach somebody like him. I said, hey, you want to do a free contest with me and see if it goes anywhere? But, you know, after he heard me sing, he said, yeah, I think I might be interested in that. And then we've got Joey Fabian, who's also originally from Atlanta, and he moved here. And he's worked with tons of people. He teaches at Griffin Instruments, teaches bass there. Simon Russell, I mean, man, when I heard him, he is just fabulous. And when he opens his mouth, it sounds like Teddy Pendergrass meets Bobby Womack, and then he plays the piano too. And he's with the James Brown Band. He's worked with Zakiya Hooker and Tommy Castro, all these people. He's just wonderful. And then my brass section is the one that really blows me away. Mike Renta is just an icon in this area, and he's worked with Sly and the Family Stone, Herbie Hancock, Buddy Guy, Taj Mahal. I mean, the list of who all he's worked with just goes on and on and on and on. And he does all of the arranging. You know, when I sit down with him and I'll come in and sing a song, Mike will chart it out for me. So he helps in the creative process I usually come in and give him a feel and sing the melody and kind of tell him where I want it to go, and we'll play with it until we get it right. Then we've got Tom Poole on trumpet, who is also another just iconic figure in the Bay Area. He's worked with Etta James for 12 years, won a Grammy with her. He's been with Bobby Womack, Boss Gags, Santa Esmeralda with Jimmy Goings. He was one of the original members. Billy Preston, Percy Sledge, you know, Dr. John. I mean, it's just like when he called me and said he wanted to work with me, I was like, why? But, you know, I can't knock it. And so once I got Mike and Tom into place, I said, well, who would you like to have as the saxophone? And they both told me Tony Peebles. And I wasn't familiar with Tony yet, but he is just wonderful. And when he came in, he's also worked with, you know, Fred Wesley, who was with the James Brown Band.
Yeah.
He's also the saxophone player for Lenny Williams now. Nina Freeland, John Lee Hooker Jr. I mean, he's just a badass little guy. We call him Little. He's the youngest one in the bunch, but next to all the rest of us, that's just as far as compared to the rest of us. He's very well seasoned, and you know he's got a BA in music theory from the University of Pennsylvania. So my whole band, when they get together, it's a show. It's not just a bar band, you know, getting up and doing a gig. It's a show, and we take a lot of pride in that. So, yes, I love my band. Can you tell?
Yeah. I mean, that picture of you all on the page where people can buy your CD, Turning on the Naughty, and you're just like all laughing and just having a great time with each other. It's just like a really great shot.
Oh, well, we have to give credit due to our official photographer is Andrea Zucker, who also shoots for the City of Memphis and the Grizzlies, and I met her at the IBC, and she has a gift for being able to catch personality in photographs, and I really love that because my band is a bunch of large personalities. And so that picture, are you talking about the one where we were at the Monterey Blues Festival? There's
yep,
like,
that's
it's
the one.
Not the horns, just, yeah, that's it. Yeah, she really caught the personality in the band there. And Simon had been doing his, Derek worked with Little Richard, and he can do some great Little Richard impersonations, if you know what I mean. And he was doing one of those Little Richard impersonations, and we all just were cracking up at him. And Andrea caught that picture.
Yeah. I saw the headshots of the brass, but yeah, that's a really that's a nice shot. Yeah. It looks
if
like
you
it.
Are you on my, if you're on my website right now, and if you
yeah.
go to the photos
oh, wow,
page,
that's a,
there's
oh, that's
one where everybody's
really nice.
Jumping up.
Yeah, I see one where everyone's standing, looks like under a tree, and that's where you have the brass section is there as well. Your arms are out. And you were just laughing.
Oh,
smiling.
Yeah. Well, maybe I can't remember what I've got on there. That one is so funny because if you look at the guys, I'm like, they call me the diva, and, you know, and I do my hands out, and I'm real
yeah.
stage, you know, like Broadway.
Right.
And Andrea goes, everybody impersonate Paula. And that was what that picture was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
So they were all acting. They were all acting diva-ish in that picture.
Right. Yeah. So woman leader, band leader, and all these guys.
It's not a bad life.
Wow, that is really great. Yeah.
Rehearsals are pretty fun too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow. And you all, you know, sound really great. Your debut CD is just really phenomenal. It's really awesome. And we'll have to play something from it when I have time to become, to be able to register. Because the format you sent the music in, I'm not going to be able to play it right now. But I'll play it a little later on for our audience on future.
All right. Well, I'll make sure you get what you – I thought you had it last night, but I'll make sure that you get what you need. So if I need to convert it for you, you just let me know.
Okay, cool, super. Well, thank you once again so much for joining us, Paula, and looking forward to seeing you tonight and also seeing you with your own band. So definitely keep me on the list.
It was my pleasure, and we did thank you so much for helping us to get the word out about this show tonight to everybody.
Mm-hmm, yeah, well, it's one not to be missed. I mean, like, how often can you see all these top-notch women on stage at the same time? Like, oh my goodness.
We were discussing that in rehearsal. It's very rare that you see an all-woman band, much less one with four, you know, vocalists that are all female vocalists, because think about it, usually when one of us is somewhere, it means the others are out of a job, you know what I mean? So it's a really unusual circumstance, and it's just a lot of fun, and the joy that they have had in you know, like when I was listening to Terry and Rhonda do their songs in the rehearsals, mm-hmm. and I looked around and everybody in the room had these big smiles on their face, and it's just so much fun to see, you know, women coming together in support of each other without any of the cattiness or the jealousy or any of that. And that's one of the underlying things that makes a show like this just such a special occasion.
And you can only find things like that here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I mean, you know, we are unique like that.
That's true. I lived in Atlanta, and you would never have seen that in Atlanta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
The Bay Area is a neat place to be from, and it's also I just hope people realize how lucky they are to be so close to so much talent.
Yeah, a lot of times people don't realize how lucky they are until they leave. And it's like, oh, my gosh, I've got to get back.
Yeah, then like my song says, it's in the nick of too damn late.
Well, again, it's been great having you on, Paula, and look forward to having you on again.
Oh, thank you so much. I'd be delighted anytime.
All right, you take good care. Have a good rest of the day, and looking forward to seeing you this evening.
Likewise.
Okay. Peace and blessings.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. So we're speaking to Paula Harris, who is performing tonight with Ron Benin, Kelly Gray, Terry Odabi, and the Lil Armstrong Memorial Band featuring Ruth Davies, Sonia Jason, Ruthie Price, and Tammy Hall, musical director, with some special guests that Rhonda Benin told us about. So Just Like a Woman, in celebration of Women's History Month, featuring Bay Area vocalists, is tonight, March 27th, 8 o'clock, at the Freight and Savage Coffee House, 2020 Addison Street in Berkeley. Phone number is 510-644-2020 or info@freightandsalvage.org. Don't forget, I'm pronouncing without the L sometimes, but I mean salvage, as in go get it, because it's priceless, salvage. Tickets are $22.50 in advance and $24.50 at the door, and you can actually get tickets online. So, get tickets and take a friend or two or three. It's going to really be a wonderful, wonderful program tonight. So now we are going to play this interview with Toby, who is going to talk about his character, John, in The Whoopi Man, again, currently opening tomorrow, the 28th of March, at the Marin Theater Company. And as I scroll, I was going to try to play something by Paula West, but I don't think that's going to happen because I want to make sure you hear most of this interview with Toby. So if that's the case, I need to get moving because it's a little longer than half an hour, and that's all we have left on the air. So we're going to go into overtime, so make sure you stay with us. And want to let you know that you're going to hear references to the N-word, so you might want to just prepare yourself for that. Because it's in the play. Alrighty. So here is Toby Winnum as John in The Whipping Man at Marin Theater Company. Well, it's so good to be talking to you again, Toby. It's been a minute.
Yes, it has. Pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, so how have you been? I know you've been busy.
I've been good, yeah, very busy. Got a lot of stuff going on in my life as far as just like acting and the art, doing The Whipping Man now. We're touring with that. Just got back from Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Here in the Bay Area right now. I think we started rehearsal like a few days ago. getting back into it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just working on a lot of projects, a lot of film projects going on, and a lot of auditioning. So, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Loving it.
Yeah. You're one of the busiest actors working around the Bay and beyond the Bay. So how was Virginia?
It was nice. It was a pleasure to be there. I never like spent time in a military town, so it was a pleasure to be there and you know, see all of the military history that it had to offer, and also to do the play, The Whipping Man. That was such a pleasure because we were in Norfolk, Virginia,
mm-hmm.
and the play, The Whipping Man, takes place in Richmond.
Right.
And the culture there just was so appreciative of having a play about them, you know, and being able to give it to that audience was a gift. So, and we had a good time. Like I really felt the ancestors were there, and everybody was just it was giving. It was a giving place. Virginia Stage Company was magnificent too.
Yeah. Is the playwright from there, or where is the playwright from?
I think the playwright's from Florida.
Okay, South.
But he has family that was that's in Virginia, and he has roots connected, strong roots to the Civil War, and like his father or something is he studied the Civil War.
Oh wow. Wow, neat. And then, you know, you're a native of Birmingham, Alabama. You know, there was war there, too. Post-Civil War and all those, you know, resolutions and amendments to the Constitution.
Right on.
Yeah, did your family get a chance? I don't know how far, like, Alabama.
They did, yeah.
Ooh.
My family got a chance to drive up. It's like 11 hours.
Okay.
They made the drive up, and it was such a pleasure to have them in the audience. They came on the last weekend. Really enjoyed the play. They thought it was very suspenseful, and I don't know, it was just, I think it was the first time my mom had seen me in a while on stage,
mm-hmm.
and to see her eyes after I finished was just, it was amazing, you know, it's, you know, just to see that your mom is proud of you was such a pleasure for me.
Oh, yeah. Oh, excellent. So why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the play? You know, you don't have to give anything away, but just tell them a little bit about what, you know, The Whipping Man is about.
Well, The Whipping Man, it takes place in 1864. I think I'm telling the truth when I say that. April, in April, 3 days in April. April, ooh, you can't, don't ask me to say the dates.
Yeah.
Right before Lincoln is killed, mm-hmm. are the dates. April 14th, yes, the 13th, 14th, and 15th. And you follow these three guys. Both John and Simon were former slaves, and Caleb is the master over the house when is part of the De Leon family.
Mm-hmm.
And he just got back from the Confederate war, from the Civil War, and he's a Confederate soldier that just come home, and just it's about the negotiations that we have and the secrets that everyone's keeping as far as, like, now that the slaves have been emancipated, what that means for John and Simon, which is two different things. You know, Simon is of a generation that John is not of. I'm playing John, which is the youngest of the two.
Mm-hmm.
And John just got his freedom, and what that means to him is something totally different for Simon. And also, what does this newfound freedom mean to this Confederate soldier that just got back? You know, they lost. You know, they lost the war. So
right, yeah.
What all of that means to Caleb, and to come home and see his house is destroyed from where, you know, all the soldiers were destroying their own houses so that the North would not be able to use any of the products, like, you know, no tobacco. They couldn't get water, so it was just destroying everything. And so he comes back and everything messed up, you know. So, and it's just about the negotiating, you know, as these emancipated slaves, you know, they're trying to find themselves and find what it's like to be free now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then also an interesting twist is that all three of us in the play, we're all Jewish.
Yes, that is a serious twist.
Mm-hmm. which I love. It's such a good story because the De Leon family is a Jewish family. And so much like many slave owners and slaves during that time, the slave owners kind of made it, they gave their religion to the slaves, you know, and allowed them to, because they had to travel with them and when they went to church, if you were a Christian, but also with the Jewish faith, because we've decided that they, one of the reasons they would give the slaves their faith was because they had to prepare kosher food.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are Jewish because we had to prepare the food. Both Simon and I
mm-hmm.
were given that faith because that was the reason. But therein also lies so many questions, and that's why John, he's a very well-read character in this play. Like he taught himself how to read at a very young age, because he was given the opportunity to, you know, explore those options through the De Leon family. Like, the mother would always encourage him to read, and so he learned how to pick up a book. And after they stopped it, he started asking a whole bunch of questions. Like, hold on,
mm-hmm.
in the Jewish faith, we're supposed to be free. You know, it says every person's supposed to be free if you're a Jew. You know,
mm-hmm.
once we're free, we're not supposed to be slaves anymore. So let's talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
And so John starts asking questions like that, and then they're like, okay, let's stop you from reading. So. That was a lie, I know.
Yeah, but it's so cool because, you know, the whole thing around libraries, you know, the really sad part, how libraries, you know, were segregated, and you know, people probably remember in their reading, those who are you know, culturally competent and literate, and the major books in our canon, we think about Richard Wright and Black Boy, and how he had to forge, this is a true story, he had to forge passes for himself to be able to use the public library in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of flashed on that when your character, John, is just reading everything he can in the home library.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just so smart. And then later on, when the three men are together, and Simon, who is the elder, I can hardly wait to see Mr. Peter Callender in that role. I bet he is phenomenal.
Oh, yeah, both Peter and Nick, we're doing something. They're just amazing partners to have on stage. And,
mm-hmm.
and then Jason Minadak is our director.
Yeah.
So he's one of the great storytellers, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're having a good time. Yeah, you're going to be in for a treat when you come to see it.
Yeah, well, you're in it. Of course. Yeah, but the whole idea of, I was just jotting down some notes when I was reading the play, and it says see, something about questions and how it doesn't weaken your faith to ask a question. You lose your faith when you don't ask the question. I thought that was like, wow, that's pretty. That's an interesting concept, because a lot of times you would think, well, you don't question it because then that'll make it weak, because the answer might make you lose your faith. But then not knowing could also make you lose your faith too, I guess.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's Simon's character, which I was telling you about.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one that says that, and you know, my character, John, can't quite grasp what that means. Neither can Nick's character. Mm-hmm. Both of us being of, like, the same age and, you know, trying to figure out all of this stuff with religion and all of this freedom thing. But Simon's character has a wisdom to be able to say that, you know. And mm-hmm. It's the play brings up issues like that about faith and do you, can you ask, is it safe to ask questions? He's like, yes, that's what you're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
But it also says, which I love, mm-hmm. is at the end it starts saying, all right, now I want some answers for you because a man has answers. Mm-hmm. You've asked a lot of questions. Now we're going to say, give me some answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what it's a great term for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and also the play is there are all these backstories that we don't know that come
mm-hmm.
out.
Mm-hmm.
in this great finale, it's like, oh my, one thing after another as they're sitting around. I can't pronounce any of the names of these, you know, these Jewish things like the, you know, this book.
The Seder and the Haggadah, yeah.
The Haggadah is
it takes us through our Seder. It's our guide through our
mm-hmm.
Seder, the
mm-hmm.
Haggadah. And the Seder is the celebration of Passover, of Pesach,
mm-hmm.
of freedom, of the slaves being freed from Egypt. So.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, it's interesting to be talking about freedom at that time, you know, in history when the three men are together. And one man, Caleb, he, you know, he's a captain, and he was a captain in the Confederacy. And then John, you know, was, of course, you know, for the Union. And then Simon, I don't know, Simon, he definitely, you know, was, you know, for freedom and liberation because of the way he references Abraham Lincoln. And then one sort of starts thinking about Abraham in a different way, you know, thinking about Abraham Lincoln, but then Abraham historically,
yes,
and then Moses.
Which is exactly should be happening.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's because he's referred to his father Abraham so
yes.
many times.
Yes.
Yeah, so
mm-hmm.
that's, I think that's a very natural tie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, this kid John, he's just like all over the place. Like, okay, you know, okay, we're reading Leviticus, right? And
mm-hmm.
and what does it say there? You know, are we heathen or are we children of Israel? And if we're
right.
children with, so what about this? He just sees the inconsistency. You believe this, but you have enslaved people, and then the whipping man. Oh my goodness.
Right.
He sounds like, whoa, I think I vaguely heard about whipping men, but tell our audience about the whipping man and, you know.
Yeah, the play's title is The Whipping Man, and it's really about the relationship that all three characters have with this unseen character,
mm-hmm.
the whipping man.
Yeah.
And it's about that relationship, but also it was, the whipping man was much like a store back in 1864. It was like you had, it's not like slaves that were on a plantation. It's very different. We were slaves in Richmond, which kind of like, it made us urban slaves in
mm-hmm.
a way.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were very used to, like, we would go out, we would be seen with our master in public places. And there were house slaves and there were field slaves. But we were mainly house slaves. And so we did a lot of things in the house. And so if you would go to the market and stuff, you would see there would be like a store for, you can get eggs, a store for you can get medicine, and then right next to that store is the whipping man, then right next to that store is another mm-hmm. store where you can get like hardware that you can put shoes on, horses and stuff like that. But it was like, it was every day. Like you would take your slave, and you want to teach them a lesson, to this store and get a service.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what that's like. And just the relationship that all three characters have with this unseen person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what I really like about the play is how, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we have this Jewish family owning, you know, African descendants, because you don't hear that story a lot. However, the playwright, he doesn't try to, you know, sweeten it because you know, as Jewish versus Christian owners. You know, he definitely brings brutality in, you know, not just figuratively with his unseen character, but literally when, you know, the stories unfold and we see evidence of this brutality. Mm-hmm. And just see how, what's the Caleb's father's name?
Mr. De Leon.
Yeah, Mr. De Leon is like, he is just, he's unseen too, but, you know, he's definitely present. He might, he's a ghost, with that, a tangible ghost, because what he does affects all of their lives.
Yep, totally.
It's
Mr. De Leon's promise to bring some money back that
mm-hmm.
has Simon and I both there, you know?
Yeah.
Plus Simon's waiting on his family to come back. So,
mm-hmm.
yeah, he has a lot of power.
Yeah.
And he's a prominent man in the community, and also Simon speaks about how much he trusts him. Also, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he trusts him despite. And so, you know, before we went on the air, I was talking to you about Django,
mm-hmm.
and how Simon, you know, in a cursory quick read, he reminded me of the character that's played by Samuel Jackson, you know, in the character itself, not the way that Simon, not the way that the two actors portrayed that particular, you know, their particular characters, and then you told me that he was, you know, the play is a deeper read, you know, and I totally agree with you that Simon is a lot more nuanced than the character that we meet in the film. Particularly because of the faith, and we get more of a backstory, you know, because, the Simon character is quite, he has a lot of depth and quite a different, you know, a lot of different aspects to him. And I love when he talks about choice, and it seems like he has a lot of integrity as well.
Totally. And I think they are similar in the huge difference between, because I did a lot of research just watching Django,
mm-hmm.
did a lot of reading of Frederick Douglass, Abraham Lincoln, and the difference between Simon and that character that Samuel, I can't even remember the character's name,
mm-hmm.
that he played is Simon's character has a lot of wisdom,
mm-hmm.
and I don't believe that he's manipulative as that character that Samuel Jackson played, because he had different agendas at all times.
Mm-hmm.
Simon is pretty straightforward and honest, and will let you know how he feels without trying to get anything from you either.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the big difference. Like the character in Django, he always had something going. I'm gonna tell you this so I can get this from you, and I'm gonna tell them this
mm-hmm.
so I can get this from them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think John, my character, is manipulative in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's always something that's underlined, and like, I'm doing this because I want to do this, and I'm here. I'm going to tell you I'm here for this reason, but I got so many other reasons why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's so much. These characters are so complex. And then when you have the fact that they were just freed,
mm-hmm.
like, not even a few, not even like 6 months, not even 3 months. They have just been freed, and what that means, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to negotiate that with one another. And, you know, you have Simon that still wants to care and take care of the house. And John is like, we're free. Let's go. Let's get out of here. What are we doing?
Mm-hmm.
But then we did a lot of research. We read this book, Bullwhip Days.
Oh, yeah, I have that.
It was historic accounts of slaves when they were free and what would happen. And it was the same way. A lot of them didn't know what to do. So they were like, you know, can I stay over here, master, on your land? And some were like, I'm getting out of here. I need to leave. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
But then they would just walk, and eventually another slave owner would just pick them up and say, hey, come work over here. And they'd be like, okay. And so it was so much going on. It was so much fear, so much I don't know where to go, what to do. But they were like, some were like, let's go. I need to move on. Others were like, let me just stay here because it's safer, you know. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Bullwhip Days is a classic. Another thing that comes up, Simon asks John, you know, what are your plans? And John, you know, he's just 20-something. He doesn't know. He doesn't have any plans. He just knows because when we meet him, he's on the lam. He's, you know, sort of not, he can't show his face. That's why he shows up at the door, I guess, with a hood over his head.
Right,
and
right,
they don't know
right.
who he is.
That's his plan. His plan is to own things. And mm-hmm. right now owning things is him going and taking things from the other houses where no one is. Mm-hmm. And that's his form of freedom, you know. It's like no one's going to be using this. By the time they get back to this food, it's going to be all spoiled. So I'm taking it now for myself.
Mm-hmm.
I'm free. So that's his plan, is to be free. Let me do what I want to do.
Mm-hmm. So right,
I think
yeah.
it's a beautiful. I think it's beautiful.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. Does you know, besides all of your research and things like that, to develop John, you know, the character that you embody, just wondering sort of like in creating this character, what did you bring to him, you know, so far, you know, as, you know, from your experience? And are there any other experiences that you've had that were able to pull on to enrich him and make him into the character that, you know, you just retired in the first run, and now you're going ready to, you're actually breathing life into him again as you prepare for, you know, the previews, and are you adding anything to him?
I did a lot of, I just being from Alabama, I brought a lot of that history and what it means for me as a black man in Alabama, which was, you know, known as Birmingham at one point in history. And I remember a conversation that I had with a mentor of mine when she was telling me, she was, I think, around 8 years old. She remember getting hit with a fire hose, and when they were protesting, and she was hit with a fire hose because they were like spraying everyone, all of the black people. They were spraying them with fire hoses, and she said she remembered it hurting, but she didn't know why she was getting hit, and she was like, she didn't know why she was getting hit, and that played a lot as I started to develop this character and get to understand John. Because I don't know what it's like to be a slave. And actually, I, at any point in time, I'm always trying to, I'm a protester myself. Like, I want to go out and speak up for black rights at all times, for people of color rights at all times.
Mm-hmm.
And so when to take on this mentality of I was once owned, I was once not a person, was extremely difficult. Because it's just something that I'm so not used to. However, like the conversations we had in the rehearsal room with Jason, Peter, and Nick, also with our stage management team, helped me, you know, really to realize this story has to be told. And this is a huge part of our American history that we don't want to talk about, especially black people.
Mm-hmm.
And especially me, and from the South, like, it's always swept under a rug. So I brought all of that. I had to bring all of that. And first of all, I had to put it on the table. And and the character, my character, John, is referred to as Nigger John. And
yeah.
I hope I can say that. And that is a strong word for me, because I had an experience with it, because I wasn't referred to as that ever in my life until I came to the West Coast.
Hmm.
And I'm
wow.
from Birmingham, Alabama. No one had ever called me that to my face until I came to the West Coast.
Hmm.
And that experience affected me. And then another experience that I had to bring was a friend of mine recently, like 2-3 weeks before I started this process, experienced a young woman, like in her 20s, call him a nigga.
Hmm.
As he, a fight over a parking space. And it's affected me on a huge level, because I'm like, wow, this is 2013, and I'm about to go and do this play with this person. And he knew, yeah, I'm about to do this play with this guy, John, and he knew that his master calling him that word was wrong. And I was like, wow, we still are using it
mm-hmm.
today. and so on, what that meant. And then also some more research that we did, even in bullwhip days, we got to listen to a recording of a slave, a freedman now. And he was using the word, and it was so every day. Like it was his, he knew what he was, and that's how he referred to himself. And just that pain that it had in me, but also that reality. And so I had to go back to those things and really figure those things out. And once that happened, the Kid John just started to happen, you know. And then also knowing that he was intellectual, like he read all the time,
mm-hmm.
allowed me to see that he could change that word to mean so many different things. He would use it to his advantage, but also use it to really cut you back with it. And so he's a clever character. And it was hard because I didn't want to bring any pedestrian, any of my 2013 colloquialisms and all of those things to this 1864, because to me these characters are huge. Like they represent a time that none of us know anything about. We just read about it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so to give him life, to make him, he needs to be my Toby. John is my great-great-granddaddy, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be able to see my great-great-granddaddy in this character. And so this is just, it's personal. It's really personal for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you said that your mother and other relatives saw you at the theater in Virginia, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I was wondering if in your family history, if any of, you know, did anyone interview or know or keep the stories alive of your ancestors that that might have known slavery, and then even before that, like coming over from Africa, like have you all done your genealogy so that you know where you're from and have those stories about how you got here?
I have not, and my mom is just now becoming interested in that story, and it's really starting. I want to know more about it now.
Mm-hmm.
Like we know that we have some Indian in us, some Native American,
uh-huh.
and so that's all interesting to me, and that's from my grandmother's side, and I want to continue to explore, but I haven't done that yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely a part of something that I'm about to start doing in the future because I want to know more. Also, a beautiful thing, we got to meet a person in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
His name was Franklin. I can't remember his last name right now. But he actually had connection with a great-great-great-grandfather that was a slave and that was also a Jewish slave.
Mm-hmm.
And so we got to talk to him, and that was an amazing conversation. And also just to see, he had his great-great-grandfather was owned by this Jewish slave master, and we got to see a will that this Jewish slave master left for people to acknowledge,
mm-hmm.
and he was leaving things to his slaves, which was pretty amazing to me to see that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
wow. Was this man, Mr. Franklin, was he still practicing Jew?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't. He wasn't a Jew at all, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
But his great-great-grandfather was. And I think at some point, I believe he mentioned that after he became free,
mm-hmm.
his great-great-grandfather decided not to be Jew anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and I definitely could understand it because it's like I want to rid myself of whatever that was
mm-hmm.
that I was going through. So I understood why he would do that. So.
Right. That's interesting that there aren't more African Americans that are Jewish for those reasons. I mean, like for this, I guess. No, I want to reverse what I just said. That, you know, African Americans didn't keep that faith, considering how many kept the Christian faith, right? I mean,
totally.
seemed like we should not be Christian.
Totally.
At
oh
all.
My goodness, but it makes sense because there weren't that many Jewish slave owners,
mm-hmm.
after doing research. It was probably like 3% of the population at that time.
Okay.
And so they, there weren't many that were giving the Jewish faith, but the Christianity, the slave masters were giving that faith, and a lot of people kept it. You know, a lot of Black Americans kept it, African Americans kept that faith. But after doing this play, I really was like, it's so beautiful to have something that reminds you every year. You have to sit down and go through this, and you remind, you're asking the same questions every year. Because once I started doing this research on what a Seder is, mm-hmm. it became kind of amazing. Like, you involve the children. They have to ask questions and certain things. Every year you embrace that my people were once slaves, and now let's celebrate them being free.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and within Black people, within African Americans, I believe that we shy away from what slavery means because it's so much of a, it doesn't empower us. It kind of makes us lose our power in a way
mm-hmm.
because we don't really want to talk about it. And I think right now, where we are right now, we're finally becoming comfortable with dealing with the Civil War and all of these things about Lincoln. And I think that's why we're seeing this emergence right now of all of these things. You know, they give us February, and we really just talk about, you know, what great people have done. Do we, and this is something in the play, it says, John, you need to, John has a line, he was like, why do we do this? And he says, to remind us of the bitterness of slavery. And then he continues to say, as if we need it reminded.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
but
right. Yeah.
Then Simon says, no, you do. You need to tell your children. So that they'll tell their children, so that they'll tell their children.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just huge to me because that's what we should be doing. Instead of, like, trying not to remember, like, hey, this didn't happen, we should say, this happened. However, we're moving to this place now.
Mm-hmm. Right, definitely. And, you know, this is the 150th anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation, so that Marin Theater Company would conclude its, you know, 2012-13 season with this play.
Mm-hmm.
And this is also the period within the play that's being celebrated around remembering the enslavement.
Oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, it overlaps.
Yeah, yeah. Today is the first day of Passover, right? Yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
yeah, it is.
Right, yeah, and they're going to be, you know, a special program, I think, on April, what's the special program's going to be? They're going to have a talk at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center on California.
Oh, cool.
Yeah,
and we'll
talk about this.
Performing on the 13th, 14th, and 15th, so that's going to be pretty cool,
mm-hmm.
of April. So,
yeah.
And those are the days in the play.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah, yeah. And then you think about, you know, Martin King, you know, you know, his, you know, the Season of Peace ends on April 4th, the anniversary of his being shot. I think it's the 45th anniversary of his killing.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, all this stuff is happening. And, you
and
know,
you definitely, you're going to feel his presence. You're going to feel Malcolm X. You're going to feel all of our Black activists
mm-hmm.
when you come and see this play. Because I think it, to me personally, I feel like it channels all of the people that have done great things. Harriet Tubman, you definitely, there's a point in the play where we celebrate the Seder, where Simon and I and Caleb have our first Seder as freed people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and to celebrate something and really just now get your freedom, it's great to be a part of. And so though all of those things come up for me. Like in the rehearsal room, I was just, things of, images of Martin Luther King came up, images of Malcolm X, Harriet Tubman, people that I haven't even seen on boats and stuff started to come up. My grandmother was a strong image for me. And all of these Black people that have done so many great things in my life
mm-hmm.
that I've seen, all of those things started to pop up. So it's nice.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. Your character was sort of, I mean, some of the language in the play, I'm like, you know, talk about occupying and
yeah.
liberation. I'm like, oh, that sounds real contemporary.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very relevant, yeah,
mm-hmm.
to right now. And it is, the playwright, he didn't want to shy from making it contemporary, mm-hmm. and that's also a big challenge for us because we know that this is not today, mm-hmm. but this is very much what some people are going through. See, as something that someone can be able to take something from this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you mentioned, General Harriet Tubman. You know, she was, you know, one of the people that was responsible for the Union's success in the war, and her 100th anniversary of her passing was just a few weeks ago.
Wow, I didn't know that.
That's awesome. Yeah, yeah, and so what people were doing that Sunday was committing themselves to walking, to being healthy. Yeah, yeah, and I'll send you a link to the website where people
Please
are talking
do.
About that.
Yeah, I want to walk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then I was thinking also about you know, John is young, and within the play we find out how, and I know the Jews traditionally are really pay close attention to lineage. And who your ancestors are. I mean, they play really close attention to that. And John doesn't know his story. He doesn't know his history. He knows that his mother died, but he doesn't know anything before that, really. And so that's really interesting. When Simon shares his history with him, I'm like, whoa, that is such a surprise. But then it's not a surprise. Simon is keeping a whole lot.
Yeah, everybody. Mm-hmm. Everybody is keeping so many secrets.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes this a very suspenseful ride, I believe, because
mm-hmm.
it's like we just keep uncovering things. And, no one wants to give up their ground because all of us want different things. We came back to this home for different reasons. And then it's like, and then we just started talking. We started talking about it, and things started to get uncovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. And then you think about the scars, the whipping. Everyone in that room, in that house, that abandoned house, they've been whipped by a lot. Not mm-hmm. just a physical whip, but what's keeping me down? What's keeping me from being free? What's keeping me from walking in the light, so
totally.
To speak.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes, I like the way you put that.
Mhm. Yeah, yeah. So, I don't want to keep you because I know this is your off day.
I'm good. Come on, I love talking about it. I love talking with you on.
Yeah, yeah. So, I was thinking about in the ritual. When they get to the part, because I could just hear Peter's voice singing that song, go down Moses.
Mm-hmm.
It's like,
go down in Jesus' land.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then you all sing together at a certain point. I'm like, ooh, cool.
Uh-huh.
That's going to be so, rumbling. then the whole question of enslavement and what that means, how, paper doesn't free us. The end of conflict, when the soldiers go home or die, in the ditches or in the mass graves, where their bodies are tossed, that doesn't free us. And so I really like that, when you all sing Let Freedom Ring, you hear Martin King, Let Freedom Ring.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. And, that was a... After doing research, because Martin Luther King made those words special.
Mm-hmm.
They used to use them, though, a lot back in the slavery days. So he definitely did his research to find those words.
Yeah.
Martin Luther King did. So, yeah. I love hearing that line because it means something to me as Toby, and then it means something totally different, as John. So I love when Simon says, let freedom ring in this house.
Mm-hmm. Right, yeah. And then when Simon says, you don't get to be free, you work to be free. And I'm like, ooh, that's great. That is a great line. And then, wow. So what are some of your favorite scenes in the play?
I love... so many moments I really enjoyed. I mean, I don't know if it's anything. I love what Peter and Nick find. Like, I love the nuances that they find in Simon and Caleb.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've been doing this now. We have the gift of having done it 4 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and people, like in Virginia, every night as soon as we finished, they rose to their feet. And, you know, and this play is so giving as far as, like, what we have to do as actors. Like, if they weren't up there, I would fall flat on my face because I need them to be on their game. And it's just, I appreciate them so much for just continuing to keep it fresh. I think that's the best thing. It's like, there's nothing that's ever the same when we get up there. It's always fresh and nuanced, so...
Mm-hmm.
I love those moments. I think that's what I'm really into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So each time that you approach a work, is it like a new marriage or is it a blended family? Like you have other family members that you're bringing with you. Like, do you bring characters, you know, within yourself that maybe might resonate with the new character? Or, I mean, not that they're going to, like, be that character, but do they come with you? Like, do you say, you know, this is a new marriage and, you know, it was great that you were...
I think that's what I do. I think I say this is about to be something new.
Mm-hmm.
I approach all of my work, I want to approach with that freshness, and I know my springboard is always from myself,
mm-hmm.
so that I try to trust my instincts.
Yeah.
And then I just try to let whoever I am and the marriage of those characters, and I mean the character and the lines that he speaks, try to connect.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I pray all the time so that, you know, God would bless me to be able to say these words and that I will be honest with who I am and also who this character is. So
mm-hmm.
that's what I do. I don't think I bring, I mean, maybe, I mean, I don't think consciously I try to bring anything else, but I do believe that there is something from Toby that I try to bring every time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been doing this a while, and so I feel like I'm becoming more mature in my acting and also in myself, which allows me to bring much more to my act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was just thinking, you know, back at your Marin Theater Company performance, you know, in Seven Guitars, you know,
mm-hmm.
and that was just phenomenal. And I was telling you that I saw some, you know, some similarity in the character, Floyd, Schoolboy Barton, and
mm-hmm.
And John. Ooh, I'm not going to put the N on the front of it. And it's interesting, you know, around the ritual, and there's ritual in both of these plays, and there's blood in both of these plays,
uh-huh.
and there's, you know, sort of a sojourner and a wayfarer in both of these plays, your characters. And then I think about Blues for an Alabama Sky that you did at Lorraine Hansberry Theater.
Uh-huh.
And that character, you know, kind of lost, you know, a little bit trying to find his place. I mean, he knew he had it, but the society wasn't ready for him.
Totally.
Yeah, and but only thing in Blues for an Alabama Sky, you know, he did have a confidant in
Angel, right?
Yeah, exactly. And what a name, Angel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, I just, and then I think about, you know, Brother Size, oh my God. And then, and Marcus and the Secret of Sweet, oh my goodness. And you know, those are just a few I've seen of you. You know, it's like I would have seen more, but I didn't know they were happening. So, you know, it's always a pleasure to see you on stage, just sharing all these stories with us. It's just so wonderful. And you mentioned that you've got some films coming up.
Yeah, I've been doing a lot of short independent films that we're gonna start. Me and my friends and team. I started putting into some festivals. A lot of writing and stuff going on. I got a lot of ideas. I'm putting out there. So continue to pray for me, and I'm gonna continue to pray because we got a lot coming. A lot coming.
Excellent. Is this coming from your company that you co-founded, Renovation Theater Company?
It is. So two things are coming from that. We're working on a play. I'm working on a few biography stories that I want to put out. One man shows. I'm researching right now. I want to do a boxer. I'm not sure who that is. Looking at Sammy Davis. I want to look at his life. I want to look at Miles Davis' life.
Mm-hmm.
And really, you know, educate people about who these guys were. Also, we're working on this story called Eulogy about Burt Williams and George Walker. They were two blackface minstrelsy performers in San Francisco, actually. I think they got their start in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
So we're adapting that into a film. And just got a lot of stuff, a lot of coals on the fire that we need to start kicking out there. So, you got to look out for Renovation Theater, Toby Wyndham, Chanel Zorro. We're going to be doing it. We got a lot of stuff coming. Also, my film, Stakes, that's the short that I was talking about. We're looking to put that in a lot of festivals. Brandon Mason and I.
So have you looked at the Oakland International Film Festival? I think that's, I'm not certain if it's April or May.
I don't think so. Yeah, that's something I'll look into.
Because, you know, you're here and it's easy. You know, David Roach is pretty cool because I remember, and also the San Francisco Black Film Festival, that's in June.
Oh, nice. Yeah, we definitely need to. I think because we're putting the final touches on everything right now, so we'll definitely be looking into those.
Okay, cool. I'm looking forward to seeing your film. That should be great. But I'm really looking forward to seeing you at Marin Theater Company. Oh, my goodness. And then we can talk about what's happening, like all the secrets. We can't say them now.
No, we can't. Don't talk about it now. You have to come. Like,
oh, yes.
Please tell all of your listeners to come and see you with the man at Marin Theater Company.
Yeah, you have a nice long run. You know, opens, you know, with previews March 28th, and it goes all the way through April 21st, which is a, you know, nice, significant length of time. And as I mentioned, they're going to be having some talks that are connected to this particular period of looking at Jewish and African Americans and slavery, you know, and the Civil War as themes, like what big themes, right?
Oh yeah, it's gonna be this is gonna be a great conversation piece.
Certainly, yeah, and it's really cool, you know, with our sister who has the play The Mountaintop.
I can't think. Katori Hall.
Down at in Palo Alto. So there's a little overlap there, but the themes are, you know, definitely the conversation can continue.
Yes.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Toby, for joining us to talk about this current work. And looking forward to seeing you on stage. And you know, you're such a seasoned actor, even though you're so young.
Well, I really appreciate that. You just made my day.
Oh, yeah. Well, you take good care, and thank you so much.
All right, thank you so much, Juan. I appreciate it. I love talking with you.
Oh, you're welcome. Peace and blessings.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye. So that was Toby Wyndham speaking about the play The Mountaintop, which is opening for previews on March 28th, which is tomorrow, at the Marin Theater Company, and it has a nice long run. So that's really exciting. And I believe we're going to close out with another Bay Area vocalist who is not performing tonight in the celebration of Women's History Month at the Freight and Savage, Just Like a Woman, featuring Bay Area vocalists, among them organizer and singer Rhonda Benin, Kelly Gray, Paula Harris, Terry Odabi, with the little Armstrong Memorial Band under direction, musical direction of Tammy Hall with Ruth Davies, Sonia Jackson, and Ruthie Price. And there are going to be some surprises, so you don't want to miss this. 8 o'clock tonight at the Freight and Salvage Coffee House, 2020 Addison Street. Phone number there is 510-644-2020 or info@freightandsalvage.org. And again, we are going to close out with a piece by Paula West, who is gracing the Bay Area with her presence. I'm so happy that she's still with us. We have so many great singers and song stylists here in the Bay Area that call this area home, even though it's kind of chilly. You know, it's spring, but it's kind of chilly. But folks are hanging in there, just bundling up, covering their chests and throats with the proper adornment so that they don't get sick. And so, gosh, what do I want to play? I think I'll play Rolling Stone, which is her arrangement and the treatment of this particular piece. It's just phenomenal. So looking forward to joining you again on Friday, the last show for International Women's History Month, and it's been really great bringing you the voices of all these wonderful women and some men, and it's been really lovely. And we're going to be doing some special tribute to Sojourner Truth. We're going to have Mr. Avery Sharp on. We're going to be having the producer and composer for the Sojourner Truth opera, which hasn't made it this way, but hopefully we'll be able to tell you that the money was pulled together and got some sponsors, and it's being performed here in the San Francisco Bay Area. That'd be really super. So it's going to really be great talking about Sojourner Truth, who's really famous for the speech she gave in Akron, Ohio, over 100 years ago, called Ain't I a Woman? So here is Paula West, Rolling Stone.
Once upon a time you dressed so fine, through the bumps of dime in your prime, didn't you? People call, say, beware, doll, you're bound to fall, you thought they were all against you. You used to laugh about everybody that was hanging out. Now you don't talk so loud. Now you don't seem so proud about having to be scrounging for your next meal. How does it feel? How does it feel to be on your own, like a complete unknown, like a rolling stone? Ah, you're going to the finer schools, all right, Miss Lonely, but you know you only used to get juiced in it. Nobody's ever taught you how to live out on the streets, and now you're gonna have to get used to it. You said you'd never compromise with a mystery tramp, but now you realize he's not selling any alibi as you stare into the vacuum mother's eyes. you want to. May God teach.